and recognized her on sight. After Mrs. Sullivan signed in, Mrs. Fitzroy verified her signature and accompanied her into the vault, where she was given her box and shown into a small cubicle. She returned the box some minutes later. Neither the teller nor the bank manager had any idea what was in the box or whether Violet Sullivan had removed the contents. In a third article, which ran on July 15th, the County Sheriff's Department's public relations officer stated they were interviewing Foley Sullivan, the missing woman's husband. He was not considered a suspect, but was a person of interest. According to Foley Sullivan's account, he'd stopped off to have a beer after the fireworks ended at 9:30. He got home a short time later and saw the family car was gone. He assumed that he and his wife had missed each other at the park and that she'd arrive shortly. He admitted to being mildly intoxicated and claimed he'd gone straight to bed. It wasn't until his daughter woke him at 8 o'clock the next morning that he realized his wife had failed to return. Anyone with information, etc. Occasionally, in the years since then, feature articles had been written about the case, puff pieces in the main. The tone was meant to be hard-hitting, but the coverage was superficial. The same basic facts were spun out and embellished, with little in the way of revelation. As nearly as I could tell, the subject had never been tackled in any systematic way. Violet's uncertain fate had elevated her to the status of a minor celebrity, but only in the small farming community where she had lived. No one outside the area seemed to take much interest. There was a black-and-white photograph of her and a separate photo of the car, not the identical vehicle, of course, but a similar make and model. The car caught my attention, and I read that part twice. On Friday, July 3, 1953, Foley Sullivan had filled out the loan papers on a purchase price of $2,145. Since the vehicle was never seen again, he'd been compelled to make payments for the next 36 months until the terms were satisfied. Title had never been registered. Violet Sullivan's driver's license had expired in June of 1955, and she'd made no application for renewal. What struck me as curious was that Daisy had described her father as close to a deadbeat, so I couldn't understand why he'd continued paying for the car. How perverse to have to go on forking out the dough for a vehicle your wife may or may not have used in running off with another man. Since there was no way the dealer could repossess the car, Foley was stuck. I couldn't understand why he cared, one way or the other, whether the dealer sued him for the balance or turned him over to a collection agency. Big deal. His credit was already shot, so what was one more debt? I put the question in a drawer at the back of my mind, hoping an answer would be sitting there the next time I looked. At 5 p.m., I locked the office and went home. My studio apartment is located on a side street, a block from the beach. My landlord, Henry, had converted the space from a single-car garage to a rental unit attached to his own house by a glass-enclosed breezeway. I've been living there quite happily for the past 7 years. Henry's the only man I know whom I'd be willing to marry if, and only if, we weren't separated by a 50-year age difference. It's tough when the perfect man in your life is an octogenarian, though a young 87 years old. Henry's trim, handsome, smart, white-haired, blue-eyed, and active. I can go on in this manner, reciting his many virtues, but you probably get the point. I parked and passed through the squeaky gate that announces my arrival. I went around to the rear and let myself into my apartment, where I wrestled with my conscience briefly, and then changed into my running clothes and did a 3-mile jog along the beach. Home again, 40 minutes later, I found a message from Cheney Phillips waiting on my machine. He proposed a quick bite of supper and said unless he heard otherwise, he'd meet me at Rosie's, close to 7. I showered and got back into my jeans.
"Well, it's an interesting proposition, I'll give you that,"
Cheney said when I'd laid it out to him. Rosie had taken our order, asking us what we wanted and then writing down what she'd already decided to serve, an unpronounceable dish that she pointed to on the menu. This turned out to be a beef and pork stew with more sour cream than flavor, so we'd spent a few minutes surreptitiously adding salt and enough pepper to make our eyes sting. Rosie's cooking is usually tasty, so neither of us could figure out what was going on with her. Cheney was drinking beer, and I was drinking bad white wine, which is all she serves. "You know what's hanging me up?" I asked.
"Tell."
"The thought of failing."
"There are worse things."
"Name one."
"Root canal, IRS audit, terminal disease."
"But at least those things don't impact anyone else. I don't want to take Daisy's money if I can't deliver anything, and what are the odds?"
"She's a grown-up. She says this is what she wants. Do you have any reason to doubt her sincerity?"
"No."
"So why don't you put a cap on the money end?"
"I did that. It doesn't seem to help."
"You'll do fine. All you can do is give it your best shot."
In the office Wednesday morning, I made a series of phone calls, setting up appointments with principals on my list. I didn't think the order of interviews would make any difference, but I had arranged the names in order of personal preference. In quick succession, I talked to Sergeant Timothy Schaefer, who'd been the investigating officer when Violet disappeared. I wanted to see how things had looked from his perspective, and I thought he'd be good at laying in the background. We agreed to meet that afternoon at 1 o'clock, and he gave me directions to his house in Santa Maria. Foley Sullivan was next on my list. Daisy had told him I'd be calling, but I was still relieved to find him cooperative. I made an appointment to talk to him after my interview with Sergeant Schaefer. My next call was to Calvin Wilcox, Violet's only sibling. I got a busy signal on that number, so I moved to the next. Fourth on my list was the babysitter Liza Clements, née Mellencamp, one of the last people who'd spent time in Violet's company. I was hoping to create a calendar of events, starting with Liza and working my way backward as I reconstructed Violet's activities and encounters in the days before she vanished. I dialed Liza's number, and she picked up after 6 rings, just at the point where I'd about given up. When I identified myself, she said, "I'm sorry, but could we talk another time? I've got a dental appointment, and I'm just now walking out the door."
"How about later this afternoon? When will you be home?"
"Really, today's a mess. What about tomorrow?"
"Sure, that would work. What time?"
4 o'clock?"
"Fine."
"Do you have my address?"
Daisy gave it to me.
"Great. See you then."
I moved on to Kathy Kramer. She and Liza were 14 at the time, which put them in their late 40s now. I knew Kathy was married, but she'd apparently elected to keep her maiden name because Kramer was the only reference I had. I dialed her number, and once I had her on the line, I told her who I was and what I was doing at Daisy's behest.
"You're kidding,"
she said, her voice flat with disbelief.
"Afraid not," I said.
So tedious. I didn't relish having to go through this routine with every other call I made.
"You're looking for Violet Sullivan after all these years?"
"That's what I was hired to do. I'm hoping you can fill in some blanks."
"Have you talked to Liza Mellencamp?"
"I see her tomorrow afternoon. If you could spare me half an hour, I'd be grateful."
"I could probably manage that. Can we say tomorrow morning at 11?
"Sure thing."
"What address do you have? We just moved."
I recited the address on my list, which was out of date. She gave me the new one with a set of directions that I scribbled down in haste. My last call was to Daisy, telling her I was making a quick run to Santa Maria and back. On Thursday, I expected to have a block of free time, so I was proposing lunch and a quick verbal report. She was agreeable and said we could try a coffee shop close to her work. Since Tanny would be in Santa Maria on Thursday as well, she'd give her a call and see if she could join us. Her lunch hour was flexible, so I agreed to call as soon as I had a break. After I hung up, I folded the list and gathered my index cards, gassed up the VW, and headed north. I was already getting bored with the hour drive each way, and not all that happy about the miles I was putting on my 13-year-old car.
Chapter 5. Kathy. Wednesday, July 1st, 1953. Kathy Kramer was working in the office at her father's Chevrolet dealership when Violet pulled up in Foley's rattletrap pickup and started looking at cars. She carried a big straw tote with a little dog tucked inside, its head popping up like a jack-in-the-box. This was Kathy's first real job, and her father was paying her $1 an hour, 25 cents over the minimum wage, and twice what her best friend Liza made for babysitting. $1 an hour was pretty good for a 14-year-old, even if his hiring her was not entirely voluntary. When his secretary left to get married, he'd wanted to advertise for a permanent full-time replacement, but Kathy's mother put her foot down, insisting he could find somebody in the fall when Kathy went back to school. Her responsibilities entailed answering the phone, filing, and light typing, which she generally messed up. At the moment, business was slow, so she occupied her time reading the movie magazines she kept in her lap. James Dean was already her favorite of the new Hollywood stars. Also Gene Simmons, with whom she completely identified. She'd seen Androcles and the Lion, and most recently Young Bess, in which Gene Simmons had starred with her husband, Stuart Granger, who was second only to James Dean in Kathy's mind. This was July, and the office was small. Glass on all sides let the sunlight slant in, heating the space to unbearable temperatures. There was no air conditioning, so Kathy kept an electric fan beside her on the floor, the face tilted toward hers for maximum effect. The air was still hot, but at least it was moving. She didn't think it was possible to sweat so much sitting down. In the spring, her gym teacher had suggested it really wouldn't hurt if she lost 35 pounds, but Kathy's mother was having none of it. Girls paid entirely too much attention to superficial matters like weight, clothing, and hairstyles, when what counted was inner beauty. It was more important to be a good person, setting an example for those around you. Kathy's mother said her complexion would clear up in time if she'd just quit picking at it. Kathy used Noxzema every night, but it didn't seem to help. Kathy took off her glasses and polished the lenses with the hem of her skirt. These were new glasses, with stylishly tilted black cat's-eye frames that Kathy thought looked especially wonderful on her. She found herself following Violet's progress across the lot. She had vulgar, dyed red hair, and wore a tight purple sundress with a deeply scooped neckline. Winston Smith, the salesman Kathy's dad had hired the month before, had his eye on the crevice between her boobies. Everybody was always mooning over Violet, which made Kathy sick, especially her friend Liza, who thought Violet could do no wrong. Kathy was struck by a sharp emotional jolt, which later in life she might concede was a feeling of jealousy. At the moment, she wondered if it was possible to have hot flashes at so young an age. She'd seen her mother fanning herself, suddenly dripping with sweat, and thought what she experienced might be similar. Winston worked strictly on commission, which probably explained why he was so interested in talking to Violet as she strolled between the aisles of used cars. Winston was 20 years old. His hair was dark blonde with a ridge of curls on top. The sides were swept back and met at the nape in a style known as a DA, which was short for duck's ass, though that wasn't a term Kathy would dream of saying out loud. Kathy could see him gesturing, pretending to be knowledgeable when, in fact, he'd never made a sale. She found it endearing. How transparent he was to her. His goal was to make enough money to pay for his sophomore year in college, and he'd confided his belief that selling cars was the perfect way to jack up his savings. He admitted he didn't have quite the knack for it that he'd hoped. He didn't even enjoy it much, but he was determined to develop his skills, taking Mr. Kramer as his role model. Temporarily, of course. He was easily handsome enough to be a movie star himself. She thought he looked wonderful in his front-pleated slacks, open-neck shirt, and white bucks. He actually reminded her of James Dean. Same cheekbones and long lashes, and the same slender build. His expression was soulful, suggestive of troubles untold. Kathy could picture him working for her father after graduation. But he had bigger dreams. Possibly law school, he said. Kathy often asked him about himself, encouraging him to open up to her. In her pencil drawer, she kept the box of pretty pink stationery she was using for the volume of poems she was writing. She liked the roses around the edge and the pale blue butterfly in each corner. She did the actual composition on wide-line tablet paper and then transcribed the finished verse onto good paper when she was finally satisfied. Originally, she'd bought the stationery for Liza, whose birthday was coming up on Friday, July 3rd. But when she realized how perfect it was, she decided to keep it for herself. She could always give Liza the Lily of the Valley dusting powder someone had given her last year. The poem she was working on was half-finished. This was only the fourth poem she'd written, but she knew it was her best. Maybe not perfect yet, but her English teacher said every good writer did constant revisions, and Kathy'd found that to be the case. She'd been working tirelessly on this poem for the better part of the morning. She took out the lined sheet and read it to herself. She was thinking of calling it 2W, without giving any other hint of whom the poem was written for. She knew many poets, such as William Shakespeare, wrote sonnets and titled them that way. 2W. When I gaze in your beautiful brown eyes, I feel my throbbing heart increase in size. With all the love I hold inside for you, I promise, my darling, I will always be true. I loved you deeply right from the start, and now no one can ever sunder us apart. If I could only hold you tightly in my arms. She hesitated. That word, arms, was a stumper. Charms would rhyme, but she couldn't figure out how to work it in. She tapped her pencil against her lips and then crossed it out. She'd come up with something better. Her thoughts returned to Winston. As a seventh grader, she'd taken a class in dating etiquette, anticipating the opportunities that would crop up for her in eighth grade. She learned what topics were suitable for conversation with a boy and what to say at the door at the end of a date. In her mind, the boy's face was amorphous, his features shifting to resemble whatever movie star she was currently smitten with. She imagined him kind and gentle, appreciative of her many fine qualities. She'd had no idea then how soon Winston would appear in her life, the epitome of all her dreams. She did think he'd exhibited a certain interest in her, at least until Violet showed up. Violet and Winston were approaching the showroom floor, where the best car on the lot, a two-door Chevrolet Bel Air coupe, was displayed under bright lights to emphasize its sleek lines. Violet had spotted the vehicle from halfway across the lot, and Winston was laying on his spiel as though his life depended on it, like Violet might actually buy it. Very funny, ha ha. She'd heard Violet and Foley were so poor they could barely afford the rent. Winston held open the plate glass door, allowing Violet to pass through. Kathy caught sight of a big blue bruise on her chin. Violet was all the time walking around like that, making no effort whatever to cover the marks. No dark glasses, no makeup, no wide-brimmed hat, which might have helped. She went about her errands, supermarket, post office, walking Daisy to school, with one or both eyes black, cheeks swollen, her lips puffy and plump from one of Foley's blows. She made no excuses, and she never explained, which left Foley looking like a fool. How could he defend himself when she never accused him of anything? Everyone in town knew he hid her, but no one intervened. That was considered their personal business, though Kathy's mother often said it was a total disgrace. Kathy's mother thought Violet was trash, and she said Liza was asking for trouble if she hung out with her. Just the night before, sitting at the top of the stairs while her parents were in the living room, she heard her mother talking about Violet and Jake Ottweiler, who'd been seen slow dancing at the Blue Moon. Violet was oversexed, a regular nymphomaniac, whatever that was, and her mother was disgusted that Jake would have anything to do with her. She was getting all worked up, her voice rising, which made it easier for Kathy to hear, when her father blew his stack. "Christ, Livia, is that all you have to do? Sit around and pass along ugly gossip? What the hell is wrong with you?" They'd argued, and her mother had hushed him because she was worried Kathy might overhear them. Personally, she'd agreed with her mother. Violet was a tramp. Kathy picked up a batch of papers and crossed to the filing cabinet by the door. so she could hear what Violet and Winston said. The two were focused on the car and didn't seem to notice her hovering nearby. Winston was saying,
"Make no mistake. This is not your basic sedan. This is Chevrolet's 5-passenger coupe, 235 engine, power glide, dual carbs, and exhaust. Full hubcaps, even has a beehive oil filter, if you can imagine such a thing."
Violet clearly didn't know a filter from a fish fillet.
"It's the color I love," she said, running a hand along the front fender.
The hood ornament looked like an eagle or a hawk in full flight, beak foremost, wings back, speeding through the air in a stylized pose.
"The color's custom, only one of its kind. Know what it's called? Violet slate, I kid you not."
Violet flashed him a smile. She made a point of wearing shades of violet, purple, lavender, lilac, mauve. Winston leaned past her and opened the door on the driver's side, revealing the orchid pink trim on the lower dash panel.
"Here, have a seat."
He cranked down the window and then stood back so she could get a better view. The seats were plush, trimmed in a robin's egg blue, with insets and side panels in a pink and blue pattern that looked like flame stitching, the two colors bleeding into each other to form violet shade. When the car had come in, Mr. Kramer had opened the trunk for Kathy, showing her the interior, which was upholstered in the exact same two shades. Even the spare tire in the wheel mount was covered in blue plush, like a tire cozy. Violet slid in behind the wheel, hands at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock, nearly feverish with excitement.
"It's beautiful. I love this."
She ran a reverent hand across the seat.
"How much?"
Winston laughed, thinking she was making a joke.
"What's so funny?"
He stared at the toe of his shoe, looking up at her from under dark lashes, dimples showing, his brow furrowing.
"Well, nothing, Mrs. Sullivan, but I believe it's beyond your means. I know it's beyond mine."
"I've got money."
"Not this much," he said, in a jocular tone, keeping things light.
Kathy could see he was trying to cushion her disappointment when he told her the price. She thought Violet was getting a bit above herself, putting on airs. Boy, was she in for a rude surprise. Violet's smile faded.
"You think I can't afford to buy a nice car like this?"
"I didn't say that, Mrs. Sullivan. By no means."
Kathy couldn't believe the woman was still pushing the point. But Violet said,
"Then answer my question."
"Sticker price is $2,375. My boss might be willing to dicker some, but not a lot. Car like this is considered top of the line, and there's not much wiggle room, as we like to say."
Kathy checked Violet's expression, hoping she'd realize how far out of line she was. Violet kept her eyes on Winston, who seemed somewhat distracted by the gap that appeared at the neck of her dress, which was cut low to begin with. She said,
"I'd want to take it for a test drive."
"Well, sure, we can arrange that."
She extended her hand out the window, palm up.
"You have the keys?"
"No, not on me. They'd be in the office, in there," he said, gesturing unnecessarily.
"Well, Winston, you'll have to go and get them. You think you can manage that?"
Her tone was silky and flirtatious, even though what she said seemed insulting to Kathy's ear.
"Unfortunately, my boss has gone to lunch, and I'm the only one on the lot."
"And?"
"And, you know, I can't just take off because he left me in charge."
"If I'm not mistaken, there's a mechanic on the premises. Two of them, in fact. What's that one's name? Floyd, isn't it?"
Both Kathy and Winston checked the service bay where Floyd could be seen, servicing a used car that had just come in. Mr. Paget had been talking about a trade-in, but then decided he'd hold off until fall when the new 54 models arrived. In the meantime, he'd said he'd just as soon have the cash in hand, so he'd sold it outright. Winston seemed relieved, as though Violet had given him the perfect out.
"Mrs. Sullivan, Floyd can't work the floor. He wouldn't know what to do any more than I could go back in the service bay and do his job for him.
Why do I need you? All I'm going to do is drive around the block. Don't you trust me?
Winston's Adam's apple dipped. I do. It's not that. I just think it'd be better to wait until my boss gets back so you can talk to him. He knows this car inside and out far better than I do. Besides, if it comes to that, he's the one who handles all the paperwork, so it only makes sense.
Paperwork?
You know, down payment, terms, stuff like that. You'd have to have your husband come in and sign.
Violet was amused.
Why? Foley doesn't have a dime. I intend to pay cash.
Outright?
Do you know how much money I have? I'm not supposed to tell, but I know I can count on your discretion, she said, lowering her voice.
You shouldn't be telling me anything personal, Mrs. Sullivan. You should talk to Mr. Kramer about your finances.
$50,000.
Winston laughed, unnerved. Seriously?
Of course. Why would I joke about a thing like that?
What'd you do? Rob a bank?
It was an insurance settlement.
I wanted more, but that's what the company offered me right off the bat. My lawyer said take it.
So that's what I did.
The two were probably in cahoots. I've never even told Foley the full amount. He'd be on me in a flash and squander every dime.
See this?
Violet pointed to the bruise on her chin.
One day Foley's going to push me too far, and that's it. I'll be gone. The money's my ticket out.
She held out her hand.
Now, may I have the keys?
Kathy watched Winston struggle with the request. She knew he wasn't much for confrontation, especially with a woman like Violet. On the other hand, she knew her dad had given him explicit instructions. No test drive without a salesman. No leaving the floor unattended.
What's your commission on a sale like this?
Violet asked, as though the sale was a foregone conclusion.
Somewhere in the neighborhood of 4%.
Enough to cover your tuition and books for the next 2 years. Or am I wrong about that?
That seems about right, he said. Even Kathy was transfixed by the notion of all that money coming to him.
So, do you want the sale or not?
Winston glanced at his watch.
I don't know what to tell you, Mrs. Sullivan. Mr. Kramer's due back any minute now.
Oh, for Christ's sake. Give me the keys and let's get on with it. I'm just taking it around the block.
Kathy closed the file drawer, rolling her eyes in disgust. Pushiness was unbecoming in a woman. Everyone knew that. But blasphemy was inexcusable. She returned to her desk and took a seat. The woman was insane. There was no way Winston was going to let her drive away in that car. Without so much as a dollar changing hands?
Very funny. Ha ha.
Kathy picked up a stack of papers and tamped them against the desk, then opened and closed a drawer, pretending to be absorbed in her work. Winston appeared at her desk. There were big damp circles under his shirt sleeves, and she could smell his sweat.
I got a problem.
I know. She is so full of herself, it makes me sick.
Can I have the keys to the Bel Air?
She stared at him, blinking.
Why ask me? Could you give them to me, please? She's buying the car and she wants to see how it drives.
I don't have them.
Yes, you do. I saw him give them to you.
Kathy didn't move because she'd suddenly had a thought. At dinner the night before, her dad told her mom he was top-heavy on inventory and light on cash. What if Violet really had the money and the sale got messed up? If Kathy made a fuss and then the deal fell through, she'd never live it down. She could feel her face burn. Exasperated, Winston leaned over and opened her pencil drawer.
There, big as life, were the keys on a ring, with the Chevrolet logo, the make and model of the car inked on a round white tag.
He helped himself to the set.
You'll be sorry, she said, not looking at him.
No doubt, he said, and then returned to the floor.
Violet was still sitting in the car. Kathy's dad would have had a fit the minute he found out, but what was she supposed to do? Winston held out the keys to Violet. She took them without a word, and then started the car. She put the gear in reverse and began backing toward the wide steel door at the rear of the showroom. Kathy watched as Winston crossed to the door and gave the handle a yank. The door ascended on its track with a low, rumbling sound. He leaned toward the driver's side window, probably to offer her advice. But Violet swung the car into the alley and took off without so much as a backward look. Kathy saw Winston glance at his watch, and she felt a little thrill of fear because she knew exactly what was on his mind. Even if Violet took the long way around, the drive couldn't take more than 5 minutes, which meant he could have the car on the floor again before her dad returned from lunch. Chapter 6. I found Sergeant Timothy Schaefer in a workshop at the back of his property on Hart Drive in Santa Maria. The house itself was built in the 1950s, by the look of it, a three-bedroom frame structure so uniformly white that it had been either freshly painted or recently covered in vinyl siding. His workshop must have been a tool shed at one time, enlarged by degrees until it was now half the size of a single-car garage. The interior walls were all raw wood and exposed studs. He'd used layers of newspaper as insulation, and I could probably read a year's worth of local news items if I peered closely enough. Schaefer had told me he'd retired from the Santa Teresa County Sheriff's Department in 1968 at the age of 62, which made him 81 years old now. He was heavy-set, his loose gray pants held up with tan suspenders. The brown and blue in his plaid flannel shirt had been washed to a blend of softly faded hues. His hair was a flyaway white, as fine as spun sugar, and he wore bifocals low on his nose, fixing me with an occasional sharp look over the rims. In front of him, on a chunky wooden workbench that lined the shop on three sides, he'd set a newly finished rocking chair, its seat in need of recaning. His tools were neatly lined up, a pair of needle-nose pliers, two ice picks, a knife, a ruler, a container of glycerin, and loops of cane held together with clothespins. On the chair he was currently caning, he'd used golf tees to hold the cane in place until he could tie them off underneath. "My daughter got me into this," he said idly. "After her mother died, she thought a hobby would keep me out of trouble. Weekends we make the rounds of flea markets and yard sales, picking up old beat-up chairs like this. Turns out to be a money-making proposition." "How'd you learn?" "Reading books and doing what they said. Took a while to get the hang of it. Glycerin helps the cane slide. Don't soak it long enough and it's hard to work with. Soak it too long and it'll start to weaken and break. Hope you don't mind if I keep on with this. I promised a fella I'd have his rocker ready by the end of the week. Be my guest." For a while I was content to watch without saying a word. The mechanics of it reminded me of needlepoint or knitting, something close to a meditation. There was a certain hypnotic quality to the process, and I might have stood there observing for the better part of the day if time had permitted. When I'd called the day before, I'd mentioned Stacy Oliphant by name, thus according myself instant credibility, since the two had worked together for a number of years. Schaefer and I had spent a few minutes on the phone discussing the man. When I told him I was looking for information about Violet Sullivan, I'd asked if he needed to clear anything with the department before we spoke.
"Oh, nobody cares about that anymore," he said. "Only a few of us remember the case. She's still classified as a missing person, but I don't think you'll have much success after all these years."
"It's worth a try," I said. "Did you know her?" I asked now.
"Sure did. Everybody knew Violet. Feisty little thing with that fiery red hair. She was a beautiful girl with a defiant streak. If Foley blackened her eye, she made no attempt to hide it. She'd sport a bruise like a badge of honor. Damnedest thing you ever saw. Black and blue, she was still prettier than any other woman in town. I wasn't smart enough to keep my trap shut, and my wife was so jealous I thought she'd spit nails. Violet was the kind of woman men fantasize about. A lot of wives ended up with their noses out of joint.
How well did you know Foley?
Better than I knew her, given his numerous contacts with law enforcement. That's how I ended up dealing with him in the first place, because of his smacking her around. I probably went to the house half a dozen times. None of us like going out on domestic calls. Dangerous, for one thing, and for another, it made you wonder what the hell was wrong with folks. Violet and Foley were skating close to the edge. Bad situation. Her little girl was of an age where she'd end up standing in the line of fire. Abuse spills over. It might start with the spouse, but the kids aren't far behind.
What about Violet? Did she have any criminal history?
Nope.
Foley never had her arrested for assault.
Nope. If she hit him, he must have been too embarrassed to call us.
Shoot. No mugshots and no fingerprints. That's too bad, I said.
She was clean as they come. She didn't have a social security number because she never held a job. So that's one more dead end. The only outside dispute she had, she took Jake Ottweiler into small claims court. His pit bull attacked her toy poodle and killed it outright. I think she collected a couple $100. Foley probably borrowed every cent of it to pay the bills.
Daisy remembers the two brawling. She says neither one went after her, but it had an effect.
I don't doubt that, he said. We sat Foley down more than once and gave him a talking to. But like most abusers, he was busy blaming someone else. He maintained Violet was provoking him, which made it her fault, not his.
This was over what period of time?
2-3 years, running right up to the last anybody ever saw of her. After we spoke yesterday, I called one of the deputies and had him pull the old file. He went back through the reports and says the two got into a bad one on June 27th, a Saturday, the week before she disappeared. Foley flung a pot of coffee at her, and it caught her on the chin. She called us. We went out to the house and arrested his sorry ass, and then held him overnight until he had a chance to cool down. Meanwhile, she filed a complaint charging him with misdemeanor battery.
Why misdemeanor?
Injuries weren't that serious. He'd broken her jaw, it had been another matter. We advised her right then to get a restraining order out against him, but she said she was fine. The minute he got out, he went straight to the house. He begged her to drop the charges, but before anything could come of it, she was gone. And that was that.
When did he report her missing?
July 7th. In those days, the law required a 72-hour wait if there was no suggestion of foul play, which there wasn't. So Sunday passed, and then Monday, without a word from her. Tuesday morning, Foley came over to the station and asked to file a report. I was the one who took the information, though the story was already out by then, and we knew we had a problem on our hands.
How did he seem?
He was obviously upset, but in my estimation, mostly for himself. Given his history, he had to figure he'd be first in line when it came to close scrutiny. We put out a countywide bulletin giving a description of Violet and the car she was believed to be driving, and then expanded that to statewide within 2 days. We contacted the papers up and down the coast. Didn't generate much interest, to tell you the truth. Most ran 2 column inches in the second section, if they bothered at all. Radio, same thing. The story got some local airplay, but not that much.
Why no splash? What was that about?
The media wasn't prone to jumping on stories the way they do now. Violet was an adult. Some had the feeling she'd run off on her own accord, and she'd come back when it suited her. Others leaned toward the notion she'd never left at all, at least not alive.
You think Foley killed her?
That's what I thought at the time.
Why?
Because the violence had escalated, and she was serious about pressing charges, which would have been bad news for him. It's like the deputy DA told me, you don't have a witness, you don't have a case. If he'd gone to trial, chances are he'd have ended up in jail. It certainly worked to his advantage that she was gone.
I'm assuming there was an investigation.
Oh, yes. We could pretty much trace her activities up until the time she left the house that night. This would have been 6:15 or so, after the babysitter showed.
It wasn't dark yet and wouldn't turn dark until closer to 9 o'clock. A couple of people saw her drive through town. They said it looked like she was alone except for her little dog, standing in her lap, yapping out the window. She stopped and bought gas, filling up her tank at a service station near Tullis, so we know she made it that far.
What time was that?
6:25, round about then. The fellow at the pump cleaned her windshield and checked her tires, which he needn't have done. The car was brand new, and he was interested in hearing how she handled. They spent a few minutes talking about that. I asked him if he noticed anything unusual, because I was curious about her mood. If she was leaving her little girl for good, you'd think she'd be down in the mouth, but he said she seemed happy. Giddy was his word. Of course, he'd never laid eyes on her before, so as far as he knew, she was always that way. I was hoping she'd said something about her destination, but no such luck. Her dog was barking up a storm, jumping from the front seat to the back. She finally let it out to do its business in the grass. After she put the dog back in the car, she went in the office, paid the clerk for her gas, and bought a Coca-Cola from the cooler. Then she got in the car, and off she went, driving toward Freeman. I opened my shoulder bag and took out a pen and my map of Santa Maria. "Can you show me the location of the service station? I'd like to take a look." He adjusted his bifocals and studied the map, opening it to the full and then refolding it.
"That'd be here," he said, making a mark on the page. "Place is still there, though the pump jockey and clerk have both left the area. From that point she could have gone any place, down one of these side roads and out to the 101, south to Los Angeles, north to San Francisco. She could have circled back and gone home. We calculated how far she could get on a tank of gas and checked with every station within that radius. No easy task. No one remembered seeing her, which struck me as odd. That car was a beauty, and so was she. You'd think someone would have noticed if she'd stopped for anything. Meal, restroom, to walk the dog. I don't know how she could have vanished like that. Literally, without a trace.
The papers said Foley wasn't considered a suspect.
Of course he was. Still is. We put that out, hoping to coax him into telling what he knew. But he was a wily one. He went straight out and hired an attorney. And after that, he wouldn't say a word. We never did come up with anything to hang him on.
He gave no explanation at all?
We managed to get a little bit out of him before he clammed up. We know he stopped by the Blue Moon and had a couple of beers. He claimed he got home a short time after that, which would have made it somewhere between 10 and 10:30. Trouble is, the babysitter, Liza Mellencamp, said she didn't see him until sometime between midnight and 1, which means if he'd killed her, he had time to dispose of the body.
He must have done a good job of it if she's never been found. Schaefer shrugged.
I imagine she'll turn up one of these days, assuming there was something left of her once the critters got through.
Also, assuming he killed her, which he might not have.
True enough.
Not that I'm arguing for or against, I said.
I understand. I go back and forth myself, and I've had years to ponder the possibilities.
Did anybody support Foley's claim that he got home when he said? Schaefer shook his head.
Far from it. They know roughly when he left the moon, but no one seems to know where he went after that. Might or might not have been home. Liza's word against his.
What about the car? I understand there's never been any sign of that either.
My guess is it's long gone, probably broken down for parts. If not that, there's always a demand for stolen cars in Europe and the Middle East. In California, L.A. and San Francisco take the biggest hit.
Even back then?
Yes, ma'am. The numbers might be different, but percentages are the same. Something like 85,000 cars stolen out of those two cities just this past year. They steal them, take them to local ports, and crate them for shipping. The other option is to drive a car across the border and dispose of it down there. Places in Mexico and Central America. If a vehicle doesn't find a buyer, it's left on the street and ends up sitting in an impound lot. You go down to Tijuana, you can see thousands, cars, trucks, RVs. Some have been there for years and never will be reclaimed.
Was the car his or hers?
He was the one signed the loan papers, but the car was hers. She made sure everyone knew that. In those days, wives couldn't get credit, even if they worked. Everything was done in the husband's name.
But why would he do that? Buy her a car, and then kill her the next day? That doesn't make sense.
He might have killed her on impulse, struck her in a rage. Doesn't have to be something he planned in advance.
But why buy the car at all? Daisy told me he could barely pay the bills. I've also heard she had enough cash to buy it outright.
I'll tell you what I think. He did it out of guilt. That was his pattern. He'd get mad, beat the hell out of her, and then do something nice to make up for it. Maybe he realized she was on the verge of taking him to court, so he tried to buy her off. She was nuts about that car.
From what I heard, Foley was stuck making all the payments, even though he never had a thing to show for it. That seems strange.
Depending on his agreement with the dealer, he said. The fellow you want to talk to on that subject is Chet Kramer of Chet Kramer, Chevrolet, and Cromwell. I'll give you his address.
Thanks. Daisy mentioned him. I'm surprised he's still in business after all these years.
Oh, sure. He'll never retire. He's got his hands on the reins, and he'll be happy to drop dead before he ever lets go.
Mentally, I went back and skimmed the newspaper accounts I'd read. One of the papers reported Violet going into a Santa Teresa bank that week and getting into her safe deposit box. Any idea what was in it?
Nope. I'd assume valuables of some kind. Like you, I've heard she had a sizable sum of cash. But you'd have to take that on faith. We got a court order and had the box drilled when it was clear she was gone. It was empty.
What about since then? I know how Stacy feels about a case like this. An open-ended situation bugs the hell out of him.
You're right about that. Once in a while someone goes back to take a look, but there's not much to go on. We never got a break on this one, and we haven't had the manpower to devote a second full-on investigation. Detectives down in ST have enough on their plates. Some rookie might noodle around with it from time to time, but that's about it.
What about the theory she was having an affair?
That's what Foley maintains, but I have my doubts. Ask around and you'll find out most people who heard the rumor heard it from him. Violet screwed around, no question about that. But if she ran off with someone, how come no one else was gone?
Chapter 7. The service station where Violet was last seen was near Tullis, a dot-sized town you could probably miss if you weren't paying strict attention. Several hamlets, like stars in a constellation, were clustered in a patch, with small two-lane roads forming the irregular grid that connected them. Tullis was to the east, on a straight line that led to Freeman, and from there to the 101. Service stations in the area were few and far between, so it was easy to see why Violet had chosen this one. At that point, she'd only had the car for one day, but she'd apparently done sufficient driving to empty her tank. Or maybe she was topping it off in preparation for whatever she did next, which is to say, died or left town. I noticed myself shifting from one position to the other. She behaved like someone who was on her merry way. But to where? And more important, did she ever arrive? When I reached the service station, I pulled in to one side and parked near the entrance to the ladies' room, taking advantage of the facilities while I had the chance. The toilet did flush, but the hand dryer was busted, and since paper towels had been eliminated in the interest of sanitation, I ended up drying my hands on my jeans while I walked around outside. The station sat at the junction of two roads, Robinson and Twine. The afternoon was hot and still, the sunlight relentless. This was September, and I was imagining the heat in July was fierce. There were endless flat fields on all sides, some looking ragged from the harvest, and some newly planted with sprigs of green. It had been late day when Violet stopped here, and it must have looked then much as it did now. The area was windy and dry, without so much as a stand of trees to provide shade. I pictured Violet's red hair whipping across her face, while she stood chatting with the fellow who pumped her gas that day. What did she think was coming next? That's what bothered me. The idea of her intentions and her innocence. In my car again, I headed west, turning left out of the station onto Twine Road. I passed a sign for New Cut Road and realized Tanny's property had to be less than a mile away. Sure enough, the big farmhouse loomed in the distance, hugging the blacktop as though hoping to thumb a ride. The incongruity of the house in the flat agricultural landscape struck me anew. Once in Cromwell, I consulted the directions Daisy'd given me. Foley Sullivan worked as a custodian for the Cromwell Presbyterian Church on 2nd Street. The building was plain, in the nicest sense of the word. White frame with a steeple, set on a wide lawn of green. A large brick wing had been added to one end. I parked in the side lot and took the walkway to the front of the church. Starting with the obvious, I tried one of the big double doors, and I was surprised to find them unlocked. I let myself in. The foyer was empty. The doors to the sanctuary stood open, but there was no one in sight. I said yoo-hoo-type things to announce my presence, hoping to avoid any appearance of trespassing in a house of God. The sanctuary was bathed in quiet, and I found myself tiptoeing down the center aisle in response. There were elaborate stained glass windows on each side of the room, and deep wine-colored carpeting underfoot. The massive brass organ pipes made an inverted V behind the chancel. The empty wooden pews were gleaming in the light. The air smelled of carnations and lilies, though there were none in evidence. To the right, behind the pulpit, the choir loft was visible. At the front of the church on the right-hand side, I could see a door that I was guessing led into the minister's study. To the left, double doors with glass uppers, probably opened into the corridor that connected the church with its more modern addition. I pushed through the double doors and found myself in a broad, carpeted hallway. Sunday school rooms opened off to the right, most with folding chairs, two with low tables and chairs designed for little kids. Everything was in order. I could smell Windex, end dust, and furniture polish. I pushed through a second set of double doors into a large social hall. Long banquet-style tables had been set up, but the metal folding chairs were still stacked on rolling carts pushed up against the wall. I imagined the room could be furnished or emptied for just about any activity or any size crowd. I wondered if church members still held potluck suppers. I hoped so. Where else could you get beef and macaroni pies and green bean casseroles made with cream of mushroom soup? As a child, I'd been expelled from numerous denominations of Sunday schools, but I bore no grudge. As usual, thoughts of food prevailed, softening the experience to recollections as rich and sweet as warm homemade brownies. I entered the kitchen through a swinging door, again saying, "Hello?" and pausing to see if there would be a response. The room was flooded with sunlight, the counters were stainless steel, and huge soup cauldrons hung from racks above the two restaurant-sized stainless steel stoves. The white enamel sinks were snowy. I was running out of places to look. Any minute now, Foley, I thought to myself. I was so focused on finding him that when he appeared behind me and tapped me on the shoulder, I jumped and clutched my chest, barking with surprise. "Sorry if I scared you." "I just wasn't expecting it," I said, wondering how long he'd been trailing me. The notion generated an uneasiness I had to struggle to suppress. "I appreciate your seeing me on such short notice." "That's quite all right." He was tall and gaunt, with sleeves slightly too short for the length of his arms. His wrists were narrow and his hands were big. He was clean-shaven, his cheekbones prominent and his jawline pronounced. His face reminded me of certain black-and-white photographs taken during the Depression, haunted-looking men in breadlines, whose gazes were fixed on the camera in despair. His eyes were a deep-set blue, the orbital ridge darkly smudged. I'd seen someone else with the same demeanor, though the reference eluded me in the moment. There was no animation when he spoke. He looked out at me from some remove, a curious distance between his inner self and the life of the outside world. I could see nothing of Daisy in his features, except perhaps the marks of unhappiness for which Violet was the source. He was only 61 years old, but he might have been 100 from the wariness in his eyes.
"Come on with me. I'll show you where I live. We can talk down there where it's private."
"Sure, fine," I said, and followed him, wondering at the wisdom. Alone with a guy like him in this big, empty church. Daisy was the only one who knew where I was. We descended one flight of stairs to the basement level, which was dry and well-maintained. Foley opened the door to what I first mistook for a large storage closet.
"This is my apartment. Help yourself to a chair."
The room he'd shown me into was maybe 10 feet by 10, white walls, gleaming beige linoleum tile floor. In the center was a small wooden kitchen table with 4 matching chairs. He had a hot plate and a small refrigerator tucked into a counter along the wall, a sofa, 1 upholstered chair, and a small television set. Through a doorway, I could see a smaller room with a suggestion of a roll-away bed poking into view. I was guessing at the presence of a bathroom beyond that. I sat down at the table. In the center was a bowl of unshelled peanuts. He sat in apparent relaxation. The gaze he rested on mine was direct but curiously empty. He indicated the nuts.
"Have some if you want."
"Thanks. I'm fine." He picked up an unshelled peanut, broke open one end, and tilted the kernel into his mouth. He opened the second half of the nut and ate that kernel, too. The sound reminded me of a horse crunching on its bit. He held on to the empty shell. I could see him feeling the waffled surface, the tips of his fingers moving across the edges where the fibers extended from the shell. I've been known to eat peanuts, shell and all, to eliminate the mess. He took a fresh one from the bowl and rolled it, pressing slightly, measuring its give. His fingers might have been moving with a will of their own, rolling, pinching.
"You're a private detective. Where from?"
"Santa Teresa. I've been in business 10 years. Before that, I was a cop." Foley shook his head.
"Why is Daisy doing this?"
"You'll have to ask her."
"But what'd she say when she hired you on?"
"She's upset. She says she's never made peace with her mother's leaving her."
"None of us made peace with that," he said.
He looked away from me and then shrugged, as if in response to some inner debate.
"All right. I guess we best get it over with. You can ask anything you like, but I want to say this first. Pastor of this church is the only man in town with any charity in his heart. After Violet left, I got laid off and I couldn't get work. I did construction before, but suddenly no one would hire me to do anything. Based on what? I was never arrested. I was never charged. I never spent a day in jail in regard to her. The woman ran off. I don't know how many times I have to say that."
"You hired an attorney?"
"I had to. I needed to protect myself. Everybody thought I killed her, and what was I supposed to do? I had Daisy to support, and I couldn't get a paying job to save my soul. How can you prove you didn't do a thing when the whole town believes you did?"
"How'd you earn a living?"
"I couldn't. I had to go on welfare. I was ashamed of myself, but I had no choice. All the time we were married, Violet wouldn't take a job. She wanted to stay home with Daisy, and that was fine with me, though I could have used the help. Some months I couldn't pull in the money we needed to cover the bills. That was hard. There's people who seemed to think I didn't care if I was behind on my bills, but that's just not true. I did what I could, but once she was gone, I didn't know where to turn. If I left Daisy for a single minute, she'd come unglued. She had to have me in her sights. She had to know where I was. She had to hang on my pant leg for fear I'd up and disappear. That's how it was. Violet did what suited her, regardless of us. She was a self-centered woman, and mothering wasn't something she did all that well."
"What was?"
"Come again?"
What did she do well? I'm asking because I'd like to get a sense of her. Not just how she behaved, but who she was.
She was a party girl. She stayed out late and drank. Sometimes she danced.
What about you? Did you go dancing as well? I asked, wondering if he was using the word as a metaphor.
Not often enough to suit her.
He replaced the unshelled peanut in the bowl, and put his big hands in his lap under the table. I could hear a popping sound, and I knew he was systematically cracking his knuckles. Did she have hobbies or interests?
Like what? Did she do macrame? He asked with a touch of bitterness. Not hardly.
Cooking, for instance, anything like that?
She fixed things out of cans. Tamales wrapped in paper. Sometimes she didn't even bother to dump them in a pan and put them over heat. I know I sound negative, and I apologize. She might have had good qualities, just none I could see. She was beautiful. I'll give her that. She had her hooks in me deep.
Why'd you stay?
Dumb, I guess. I don't know. It seems so long ago. Sometimes I can hardly remember what it was like. Not good, I know. Why I stayed was I loved that woman more than life itself.
I understand, I said, though the statement was preposterous given what I'd heard. He went on.
Anyway, I'm not the only one who had complaints. She wasn't happy, but she stayed on too. At least until she went.
Daisy tells me you believe she was having an affair.
I know she was.
What makes you so sure?
Aside from the fact that she told me?
Really? What did she say?
She said he was twice the man I was. She said he was a tiger in bed. I don't want to go into that. She'd cut me to the quick, which is what she intended.
Maybe she was making it up.
No, ma'am, not her. There was someone all right. You can trust me on that.
Do you have any idea who?
No.
There was no one you suspected, even the tiniest bit? He shook his head.
At first I thought it was someone from Santa Maria or Orcutt, somewhere like that. But there was never a claim from anyone else about a missing spouse, which is why no one gives credence to anything I say.
Let's talk about you. What's your story?
I don't have a story. Like what?
I shrugged. Were you ever in the military? He shook his head, his expression sour, as though I was adding one more item to his list of grievances.
Army wouldn't take me. 1941, when the war broke out, I was 15 years old. As soon as I turned 18, I tried to enlist. But the physical messed me up. Teeth were bad. You were supposed to have 6 biting teeth and 6 chewing teeth lined up right. I didn't get mine fixed until later. By then, I could see how being in the Army wasn't such a hot idea. Bunch of boys from around here went off and never did come back.
Daisy told me Violet was 15 when you married her.
Bet she told you why, too.
I know she was pregnant. Did you ever think about putting the baby up for adoption?
Violet would have done that or worse, but I stood in her way. I wanted that child. I wanted to get married and raise a family. She acted like I forced it on her, which maybe I did, but I thought she'd adjust.
15 is young, I said, stating the obvious to keep the conversation afloat.
Violet was never young. She told me once she was fooling around by the time she was 12. I wasn't the first to have her, and I certainly wasn't the last.
Did that bother you?
Her past? I didn't care about that. What bothered me was everything she did after. You probably heard I hit her, but there's 2 sides to every story. She was unfaithful, time and time again, and I defy any man who says he can live with a thing like that. Could you live with it?
That's what divorce is for, I said blandly.
I know. But I loved her. I didn't want to live without her. I thought I might knock a little sense into her. That's all I was trying to do.
I know I was wrong. Sometimes I can't believe I ever thought that way, but I did.
She was stubborn, willful, and she never changed her ways. I was as good to her as I knew how, and she left us anyway. about broke my heart.
And you never remarried?
How could I? I have nothing to offer. I can't say I'm divorced, can't say I'm a widower. Not that any woman's asked. Once Daisy left home, I took this job. Pastor gave me a place to live, and I've been here ever since.
He was silent for a moment, emotion churning under the surface.
Tell me about the car. I can tell you exactly. Her and me had a fight. I forget now over what. I tore down a panel of her lace curtains, and she went berserk, tore down the rest and threw them in the trash. She went over to the moon, and I followed her. We started drinking, and she calmed down some. I thought everything was okay, but that's when she up and told me she was leaving me. She said it was over, and she'd be gone the next day. I didn't believe a word. Violet said things like that every other week. This time, she was crying so hard it tore me up. I was sorry for what I'd done. I knew those lace curtains meant something to her. I wanted to make up for that and everything else. She'd seen the car a couple of days before, and that's all she talked about, so I went down to the dealership and bought it. I drove it home that same day and parked it out in front, then went in and told her to look outside.